from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Our brains are especially amazing in the early years of life. Incredible adaptability, plasticity, great for learning, association, shaping our sense of self. What if a pill could take your brain back to that plasticity, give you that mental flexibility and learning capacity again? Would you take it? What if it played with your sense of self? This hour on Point, a pill to make your brain young again. Joining me now in the studio is Takao Hinch, professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School at Boston Children's Hospital and professor of molecular and cellular biology at Harvard Center for Brain Science. He studies brain plasticity, as it's called, and critical periods in brain development. His new study with Alan Young was published last month in the academic journal Frontiers. It looks at a pill that might allow the brain to absorb new information, learning, as easily as it did before age 7. Takao Hinch, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Okay, we heard you over the weekend on NPR with Linda Wertheimer, and there was just enough there to really catch our attention. We want to dig on in with you. This is absolutely fascinating. And people are always thinking about their brains and other brains and what's rigid and what's flexible and learning. Who doesn't want to be able to learn? Tell us about the heart of your study, what you saw. And you began with Linda. Maybe we start here with what you looked at, a particular drug, and what it made apparently possible with people learning perfect pitch.
Yes, this was a proof of concept study, if you will, to see whether our recent understanding of the biological mechanisms that underlie these critical developmental periods in brain development would apply also to humans. And one way to test this would be to try and reverse this kind of developmental process in older subjects. And this is what we attempted. We were able to take advantage of a drug that has been clinically used for quite some time and to pair that in healthy volunteers with a variety of training tasks that are typically seen as skills that we acquire early in life, and to see if they would improve in this performance.
So when you say reverse this process, this is the kind of increasingly rigid nature of our brain. You're looking if you could turn that around. It's already been done in mice quite a lot. You brought it to humans here. What was the drug? How did you dish it out, and what did you find?
Well, the concept here is that the brain becomes less plastic, if you will, less adaptable or changeable to environmental stimuli. And we've recently taken a different perspective on this question, that critical periods such as these do not close permanently because the brain is losing its ability, but rather the brain wants to stabilize. And it's this notion that there are a variety of factors that may actually come on with age and put on the brakes, if you will, on brain plasticity.
But the potential for plasticity is always there, and the brain is like tapping the brakes or putting on the brakes over time to close down some of that plasticity.
That's right. This is the new perspective. And the drug that we used was one of a class of drugs that acts on particular enzymes that make gene expression less accessible. And these are called HDAC enzymes, histone deacetylase. And the drugs we use are HDAC inhibitors. And so by inhibiting the action of these factors, we open up gene programs.
All right. So you took this to some volunteers and you took on the issue of perfect pitch. Perfect pitch is very rare, maybe 0.01% of the population, I read. Describe for us what it is, when people get it, when they don't typically get it.
Well, perfect pitch is one example of a skill acquired early in life. It's the ability to name or produce a tone of particular pitch without the benefit of a reference tone. And so it is rather rare. And it has been reported in people who've had musical training from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And typically, there seems to be a critical period within the first 6 or 7 years of life when some kind of exposure or training to this sort of naming of tones is necessary.
That's middle C or whatever it is.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. If you don't get it in those early years, Do people acquire it later in life, naturally?
Well, there are occasional anecdotal reports of people claiming to have acquired it, but there's no systematic evidence that adults can acquire this absolute pitch.
Because that plasticity of mind perhaps is gone, or the brakes are on it. You took those brakes off with what drug and with what result?
Right. So as I mentioned earlier, one class of these brakes on plasticity might be HDACs. And so we provided an HDAC inhibitor. The one we used was called valproic acid. And this is a drug that's clinically used for primarily two purposes. One is as an anti-epileptic agent, and another is as a mood-stabilizing drug in mood disorders.
And it's been around and used for a long time, so long that it's a generic drug at this point.
That's right.
So it's got all its approvals, sign-offs from the government. It's safe and legal. Who did you give it to, and what happened?
Well, we recruited young adult males, subjects, and were very careful in making sure they had no musical training. We also looked at a number of other critical period-like events, like language, discrimination of native versus non-native speech sounds, or the ability to discriminate faces. For example, our ability to discriminate individual humans is something that we're quite good at as humans throughout life, but we lose the ability to discriminate individual animal faces, for example. And these are all very similar early experience-dependent processes of perceptual narrowing, if you will. And we asked the subjects to take valproic acid or a placebo control, blind to what they were taking. And over a rather short period of time, 2 weeks, this was paired with training online of a variety of these kinds of tasks, and then they were tested.
So in the case of perfect pitch, listening to different tones to see if they could recognize them or not, were you teaching them or leading them, seeing if they could learn it with some assistance there, I guess?
Right. We were training them to label notes with names, essentially, something they would not have done without having had musical training. It was also important that they were not multilingual, for example. Certain languages are tonal and therefore might have predisposed them to learn something like this. And of course, we were also interested in their ability to change their perception of native versus non-native sounds.
So you loosened up the brains with the valproic acid, and the result was?
Surprisingly, of all the things that we trained the subjects on, they did better only on one, which was this absolute pitch task. So they were able to name different sets of tones provided at the end of the training with greater accuracy than the control subjects.
What do you take from this? It's just a kind of proof of concept. This is very early days here. There's been a lot done with mice. But what do you take from the results of this study?
Well, it's a small study, and it takes an idea from rigorous work in the laboratory that suggests plasticity is something that we don't actually lose, and that perhaps it is masked or dampened, and that we could, in certain circumstances, bring it back or coax it to similar levels, at least functionally, as seen in childhood.
Does this mean there's a possibility of this, you know, a pill to learn a skill scenario here? Take valproic acid, study Swahili, study Chinese, and you're going to be in a better position to learn it. Is that the implication or one of them?
Well, that is one implication. I guess what was surprising for us is the specificity of the result. And it is giving us a lot to think about. So it's thankfully quite hard to change the brain. And even under these conditions, we were able to change absolute pitch performance, but not their language performance, for example. And this suggests to me that the drug is offering an opportunity, but we still need to find the optimal training that takes advantage of this situation in the brain.
Do you look at the brain becomes more rigid over time? Do you look at that as a handicap or as a positive good in some way? I mean, evolution's at work here. There must be some reason for that.
That's right. From mouse to human, there is strong evidence for these kinds of developmental critical periods and a gradual reduction in plasticity. And this suggests that evolutionarily it's somehow beneficial to be very malleable early in life when we are first encountering the world, sensing new experiences. But at some point, it becomes important perhaps to stabilize neural circuitry in order to process on a daily basis the information that we're dealing with.
Is part of that an existential, philosophical thing? I mean, the child's wonderment and maybe even lack of sense of self in a certain way could be hard to handle for a full life.
Well, that's entirely possible that the child is able to incorporate so much into his or her own identity because of this plasticity. But then as an adult, this could become detrimental. And it's possible that this might be, shades of this might be seen in certain mental illnesses, for example.
Do you have language learners already asking, how do I get the pill? I need to learn Italian fast?
Well, the response to this study has been overwhelming. We would like to caution, of course, the use of such drugs, but the promise is there, yes.
Takao Hinge, please stand by. This is absolutely fascinating. We want to dive on, and listeners, join us. Would you take this pill? Are you sure? Would you take it to help you learn a language, get perfect pitch, switch on your brain's plasticity? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new research on the brain, brain plasticity in different stages of life, and the idea of a pill that could, in effect, make your brain young again and able to learn, adapt like a child. Takao Hinch is with me, professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School at Boston Children's Hospital. He's got a new study out that looked at exactly this issue, and participants were able, with greater effectiveness, to learn perfect pitch, something that is very rare and almost never learned as an adult. But these adults' brains apparently gained a plasticity to make it possible. We'll talk with his psychopharmacologist partner in this study, Alan Young from London, in a few minutes. Takao Hinch has had overwhelming response to this since he talked with Linda Wertheimer over the weekend on NPR. Sounded like there was more to follow up on here. Takao is with me in the studio. And we asked our listeners, you know, if this would make this, would you take it? And, of course, right off the bat, a lot of people responded, well, look, David says on Facebook, look, it's there. It's called pot, you know, and he's not the – many people are saying that. Others, you know, absolutely. Carlos is very excited. I would learn at least six or seven languages, maybe even Latin, ancient Sumerian, ancient Egyptian too. I mean, adult minds are not so rigid that they don't soar at this notion for many people. But others are doubting the whole real practicality of this. You know, here's somebody who says, look, if there were fairies flying out of my ears, would it tickle? I mean, you know, is this for real, or is this some super abstract, never going to be applied, messing around in the lab kind of research, Takao Hinch?
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, this was a proof of concept study to see whether several years of exciting research in the laboratory telling us about the biology of the developing brain would apply also to humans. And, of course, some might see the ability to acquire something as frivolous, say, as absolute pitch, mm-hmm. as not justifiable for taking a drug. But, in fact, our inspiration is the ability to perhaps leverage this information for treatment of developmental disorders or brains, adult brains that have been impacted by trauma or stroke, and where the closure of such plastic windows might actually be detrimental. And what we're trying to understand here is this a very fundamental principle of brain maturation, which potentially could be leveraged in a therapeutic setting?
You talked with Linda about this possibilities of learning, maybe even greater capacity for learning language. This is very early days, and who knows? But just at the end of your conversation, and this intrigued us, you were beginning to caution that, wait a minute, when you take the brakes off the brain's plasticity, if that's the right way of putting it here, it's not just learning capacity that you open up. I mean, lots comes into play conceptually here. We are different as children in our sense of selves, What about the implications more broadly than learning a particular skill?
Right. We're talking about recreating a brain milieu that's similar to our first experiences in the world as a child. And if you can take yourselves back to that time, then you realize that the brain is capable of acquiring any language. This has been shown very elegantly by one of our vital collaborators on the study, Janet Werker, that infants born anywhere are capable of hearing the speech sounds of any language. And it's through this critical period developmental process of experience that they prune away those kinds of discriminations of speech sound that are not found in their native tongue. And so if we could truly reopen such a window, do we run the risk of resetting our hard-fought, hard-earned language and identity in that sense to enjoy the benefits of plasticity again? I think people are hoping for some kind of drug or manipulation that would allow them to retain the good things that they have already acquired and then be able to build on that. And these kinds of questions were in the realm of science fiction, but perhaps we're getting much closer to that day than we think.
Would it be a rifle shot or a kind of general loosening? We've got lots of listeners calling for you. Takao Hinch is with us. Anne Marie in Rochester, New York. Anne Marie, what do you think? You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a music professor at a very selective conservatory,
mm-hmm.
and I can tell you that the perfect pitch idea is certainly not considered a frivolous concept or skill in the area of people where I work.
Yes.
I'm curious, in the study, I know the participants that were recruited to see how well they did with absolute pitch acquisition, I know they started at a level zero. They had no musical training whatsoever. And I'm wondering if that accounts for the reason that they were able to show great improvement in their absolute pitch acquisition, whereas the other skills you tested them on, you couldn't be certain that they were at zero.
Anne-Marie, stick with us. Takao Hinch?
That's a wonderful question. This study is so small that it needs to be replicated in a number of different ways. And this is just one of many parameters we would like to explore further. What was it about the subjects or the training that we provided and that led to this kind of outcome? I should remind you that it was a very short paradigm, basically 2 weeks of drug exposure in the presence of this training.
That's pretty incredible right there.
Yeah. And so we would love to know what are all of the details that made that possible, say, and not allow the phoneme discrimination to be changed.
Emery, what about in your own family? Does everyone have or not have perfect pitch or...
Well, we're all professional musicians, and my mom and my sister both have perfect pitch, but I didn't get it. So you can see I have a vested interest here in retreating to a time when my brain was more plastic and hopefully acquiring it.
You're deep in the family biz. If you could take a pill for 2 weeks and gain it, would you consider it?
Absolutely, I would. It would help me so much. It's such an amazing skill to have as a musician. I know people who've grown up having it. You know, the students I have at the music school,
yes,
who have perfect pitch, are very. They often say, "Oh, it messes you up. It throws you off." But you know, mostly, I have one student who calls it her superpower. It's an advantage.
There's one listener in Rochester, New York, ready for superpowers. Anne-Marie, thank you very much for your call. One more right here, Michaela in Boston. Michaela, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
If I heard correctly, just based on the findings, it sounded like that this was highly effective for perfect pitch, but not for language.
I'm just wondering
if there's implications that this acid is most effective for sensory cortex and not so much for deeper learning parts of the brain.
Takao Hinch?
Well, when we say language, in this case, we're talking about sensory discrimination. So we were quite surprised that it would be less effective there. Basically, we were asking people to hear speech sounds from a foreign tongue that they normally wouldn't be able to discriminate, not having been raised in that environment. So at some level, it should have been a similar kind of issue. But there are so many reasons why one might have a negative result. For example, it might take longer to be able to do that. Or, as we found, the naming of tones was perhaps more strictly enforced during the training program than the speech sound discrimination. And so there are a variety of parameters, as I've mentioned, that we'd like to go back and revisit now, having this bioassay, I suppose, of brain plasticity.
Michaela, thank you for your call. You mentioned identity a minute ago as distinct maybe from skills or learning. And it makes me wonder, you're talking about these waves or this progression of plasticity and rigidity in the human brain over time. Is identity itself somehow related to the brain becoming more rigid? Is identity a matter of being settled? If the brains were made more plastic for some period of time, could identity begin to drift? Are people going to, like, I don't know, walk out of their job, throw over their marriage, you know, become a whole new me and off they go?
Well, we're starting to get a bit philosophical here.
We are.
Identity is, I use that term as an example of something on the higher end of cognition. It's an integrated gestalt of your persona. The notion of critical periods, in fact, is hierarchical, that these windows of plasticity come on earliest in the primary sensory areas, for example, and then this segues into associational areas and higher order brain regions. And so in sum total, after several years of development, then all of these parts are established and working together to create who we are, the motor skills we have, the language we speak. And so if we are able to manipulate even one of those windows, what the impact might be on downstream integration is a very important question.
Is the upshot of what you just said that our identities might become fluid? Maybe they always should be. Maybe they are, and we just deny it. But how do you think about that?
Right. So how interrelated are all of these components that make up who we are is a very important question. Can these sorts of drug treatments, which are identified in animal models using primary sensory areas, generalize to higher order areas of the brain? Or are higher order areas of the brain the consequence of lower centers being integrated and properly set up? These are very interesting questions which suddenly become amenable to study.
Takao Hench is with me in the studio. He's professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Out with his new study with findings that, though based on a small population, are getting a lot of attention. His partner in the study, Alan Young, joins us now from London, psychopharmacologist, director of the Center for Affective Disorders at the Institute of Psychiatry at King's College, London. His research focuses on mood and anxiety disorders, as well as the effects of drugs on the brain. Alan Young, in London, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me on, and hello again to Takao.
Great to have you both. People have been taking this drug for a long time for all kinds of reasons that Takao laid out earlier, mood disorders and so on. You must have had some experience or exposure to that population. Were those people who were taking this for mood disorders suddenly running out and gaining perfect pitch and learning Swahili?
Yeah, I think I can I've been listening for the last 5 minutes or so, yeah. And I think I can add a couple of comments to what's going on. I mean, I think one of the reasons that Takao, Janet Verker, and myself and others chose this drug is because not only did it have the potential for changing plasticity, but we also knew that it was a safe drug, safe enough to be given clinically. It had been given to, you know, tens, maybe even hundreds of thousands of people for epilepsy and for mood disorders over the years, so it was something that was available for us to use. And having, you know, done lots of systematic reviews and looked at the data and treated hundreds or possibly thousands of patients with this, you know, we don't see their identity changing markedly and so on. Generally, there's a treatment of symptoms. And what we're looking at here is really a very subtle change, which really goes back to the question that I think the second last caller that I heard, the professor of music, was talking about the abilities of the people that were in the subject, that were in the study. So when we're studying in an experiment, an experimental outcome, regardless of whether it's perfect pitch or anything else, we want people who are somewhere in the middle of the range so that they can show improvement or they can show decrements.
Yeah.
And, you know, if everyone in this study had perfect pitch, which would be very unlikely because it's very rare, you know, we wouldn't have shown any benefit whatsoever.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And also it's possible that people that were totally at the other end and were, you know, no better than random at identifying notes, we wouldn't have been able to show any decrements.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing about this population is they were normal. They were young enough to be able to still plausibly be within sight of neuroplastic windows. And they were as young as we could possibly make it in terms of the experimental details.
How young would that be? I can imagine some older listeners who have been thinking here, maybe this is for me. I'll do my crossword.
They were essentially between 18 and 20. It's very difficult to do experiments younger than that, because younger than that, you're talking about children and there's much more concern.
So you weren't switching on the plasticity in a 90-year-old here?
No, we weren't. But the point about this is that this was a proof of principle.
Mm-hmm.
So the proof of principle, and this, as Takao said, this needs to be replicated, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. There's lots of questions. But what's really exciting about this is it shows that it's possible to change, even in a very, very small way, something which seems to be a fixed brain function and is potentially amenable to change. And it means that, you know, there's a possible molecular pathway to alter brain function. And if one can conceive that future research might eventually end up with much more powerful tools to sort of change this, and that may not happen like that at all. But that's the reason there's been so much interest in this, I think.
And if there were such a molecular pathway, hypothetically, what are we talking about that extending to? Are we talking about Alzheimer's and other brain disorders that come with rigidity and aging, or something else?
Well, the truth is we don't really know. I mean, scientists mm-hmm. like me always use the analogy of the NASA program to put a man on the moon, which gave rise to the non-stick frying pan. So, you know, because of the Teflon that was used on the heat shields,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to predict where this is going. But it would be potentially disorders of cognition, Alzheimer's, perhaps even changing normal aging, which I think would be incredibly interesting. But we're talking about the basic mechanisms of the brain and how genes interact to turn off brain function. And if that can be reversed or modulated, then the potential therapeutic options are just huge.
Would you give up a little brain rigidity for those capacities, or are you attached to your brain the way it sits today, Alan?
Well, my brain's perhaps not an optimal specimen at the best of times, but I think we're in the difference between health and disease here, and I mean, I think it's all right to think we'd all want to be 25 again, but we may see a treatment with this mechanism that perhaps reduces the early stages of cognitive decline that increase your risk of further Alzheimer's and so on. So I certainly would think that this is a very exciting way to go. I don't think it's the fact that if we take Valproate, we'll all be able to, be better musicians.
Yeah.
Exciting and interesting though that is, but it's unlocking these molecular mechanisms which may have huge implications for our understanding of brain function and how to alter it in health and disease. It's really exciting.
Alan Young, please stand by in London. Takao Hench with me here in Boston. We're talking about brain plasticity and possibly manipulating it for learning, for more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about new research on the brain plasticity in different stages of life. And the idea of a pill that could in effect make your brain young again and able to learn, adapt, like a child. Takao Hench is with us, professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. He's with me here in Boston. Alan Young joins us from London, psychopharmacologist at King's College in London, the Institute of Psychiatry there. Alan, Takao, please stand by. Lots of callers for us. Seth in Boston. Seth, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I take valproate acid daily, and I haven't noticed any change in my musical ability, but I take it as part of therapy for bipolar disorder.
Okay.
And I was curious as to what your guests might think about that. Theoretically, my disease could be seen as either a failure of my brain to retain its plasticity, and then if I have a acute episode, that's a manifestation of perhaps that.
Yeah.
My brain
maybe
passed its point of breaking.
Right.
Not plastic enough, or that my brain is too plastic, and that swings from one extreme to the other. A little bit too easily.
Seth, let us pick it up. Alan Young, you're our psychopharmacologist. You hear Seth? He's on it. He knows it, but he's thinking about the notion of plasticity in regard to bipolar.
Yeah, I mean, I think Seth has raised lots of really interesting points here. I mean, I'm a clinical psychiatrist as well as a psychopharmacologist, and my special area of interest is the drug treatment of bipolar. And we know people with bipolar disorder have impairments in cognition, which are relatively subtle, but, you know, can often be quite disabling. And we've actually published studies about some medication that can actually enhance this. We did a couple of studies with a stress hormone antagonist that improves some aspects of cognitive function in bipolar disorder, particularly measures of working memory. So this is a big problem for patients. It's not just something which needs to be investigated medication-wise, but it's also something which there's things like cognitive remediation strategies and so on and so forth which might be useful. I think the first thing to say is that we wouldn't expect anyone subjectively going on valproate to notice a difference given the magnitude of the effect that we saw in normal volunteers. Because this was statistically significant. It was quite clear scientifically, but it's not necessarily something that you would notice subjectively. I guess it might be like if something made you half an inch taller, you know, no one might notice it, but if you measured it carefully, it would be very clear. So that's the first point. The second point is that the cognitive impairment that people with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and depression suffer is complex and has multiple causes and contributory factors. But I suspect that some medications may actually be useful in helping it. Indeed, this is one of the reasons that I came into this, because if we actually had drugs which could, you know, increase plasticity, potentially reverse cognitive impairment, that would be a big gain for patients. It would also be important economically, because one of the big causes of disability in things like bipolar and depression is the lost ability to work because of these cognitive impairments.
What about Seth's core question there? He's just speculating about whether your plasticity rigidity spectrum applies to bipolar and whether bipolar represents one or the other in an extreme.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think that's a very big question. We know that bipolar disorder is a disease which manifests in a sort of evolving pattern over time. So what happens on average with people with bipolar disorder is they may have some mood lability during their teenage years and then episodes of depression, and then maybe only clearly become bipolar disorder later. So I think Seth's hitting a very, very important point there. There may be some fundamental change in plasticity, which is subtle but important for bipolar disorder. We know there's old findings about things like the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, which is very important for neuronal membranes, which are abnormal there. So, yeah, that's a very good point and bears further examination, I think.
Seth, thank you very much for raising it. Let's look at more here. Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. Francis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, everyone. I'm a pediatric occupational therapist, and I would love to see some of my kids with TBIs, brain injuries, who are struggling so much in school. It's like the rest of their school time They struggled to teach these kids in the school system, and it would be very interesting to see if their future could be optimized if something like this were developed as a treatment for them.
Francis, do you mean brain injury as a result of concussion or that sort of thing, or?
Hit by cars, gunshots, but either way, the school system still works to provide them their education, but they run into so many issues, and brain plasticity is altered in various ways. It is sometimes their global injuries, you know, lack of oxygen, but that would be just awesome to see if this could help them have a future.
Let us lean in that direction. Takao Hench, you're our neurology professor here. What do you say?
Well, this is, in fact, our motivating force in trying to understand why these critical periods wind down. If we could, in fact, leverage the break insight to give a second chance or to offer an opportunity for retraining other parts of brain that weren't injured, for example, to take on new function, that would be a wonderful outcome of this kind of research.
The break insight, again, being that the brain naturally sort of puts the brake on plasticity over time, but you might lift those brakes a bit.
That's right.
Maybe there. Christopher, Beverly, Massachusetts. Christopher, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was just curious. It seems we've been talking a lot about how this neuroplasticity will help us to learn new topics, and we're delving into other things. Now, I was curious, I have friends who suffer from childhood-inflicted PTSD, and I wonder if, provided this new neuroplasticity, they could relearn things that were maybe potentially detrimental to them as adults, you know, something that was imprinted them as a small child, and maybe now with a drug like this, they could maybe relearn how to perceive certain things.
Yeah, so PTSD, not from war, but from early childhood experience. Alan Young, what about it? Does this offer the, I mean, we talked earlier about our identities. Those in part are definitely from experience during that period of early hyperplasticity. If you go back there, is there the chance of a fresh start?
Yeah, I mean that's an intriguing question. Again, a very intelligent question from the listener who's phoned in. Yes, that's possible, but I think this raises another interesting issue that it's possible that you might also make things worse. Remember, with any treatment, that we've also got to be aware of, you know, both the benefits and the potential harms. My understanding of PTSD, of course, is that this is almost too much learning and retention of the bad experience. And, you know, there are certain studies that show that some agents which blot out or reduce the memory's ability to record events actually reduce the risk of people having PTSD. So I think, yes, when we get a potential agent like this, we look at it in all different disease areas. But I think we've also got to be aware of potential downsides. And there is a possibility that, you know, it might make some things worse.
Takao Hench, what about it, the trauma in that early plastic period and the possibility for a reversal? I mean, I think about people who are plagued throughout their lives, you know, have years of psychotherapy, maybe to deal with things that, trying to dig back to things that happened to them, change them. We're going to see, I don't know, prison wardens walking, you know, down the cells, passing out your acid, you know, for people who had trauma that may have led them into difficulty.
I think it's important to keep in mind that these various symptoms and brain functions are played out in particular circuits in the brain, and we need to learn more whether these basic mechanisms identified first in primary sensory areas, for example, apply more generally to these other areas involved in emotion regulation, for example. Mm-hmm. I think we're finding in the field that these ideas will, in fact, translate, and we can become more and more sophisticated in the types of tests that we do and the brain regions we study. But the underlying philosophy is the same, that as these windows close out, these breaks might come on, perhaps at different times in different regions, and we may need to target the timing as well as the particular therapy or training to suit the circuit that we're hoping to fix.
Alan Young, what about the idea of an identity remade through conceptually here?
Well, I think the idea of combining a medication which might enhance plasticity with psychotherapy is a very, very interesting one. It's not particularly new. I mean, people in the 50s, the 1950s and 60s were combining psychedelic medications.
Doors of perception and all the rest, your Aldous Huxley.
Yeah, yeah, LSD and so on. And the idea was that would loosen up your associations and help psychotherapy. That ran into some problems. But we're dealing with a slightly different thing here. I mean, no one's saying that, you know, valproate had any psychedelic effects. But it's possible that an agent like this, which enhances plasticity, might also have a synergistic effect with psychotherapy. That's something which really would be very exciting, and I think is reasonably credible as a hypothesis.
You talked earlier about aging, and of course there's lots of research going on that front, and as the population ages, lots of interest there. Is that's a related continent here, but would it mean you might stop aging but become a different person?
Well, I mean, my understanding of what happens with personality as we age is that, as you said, we get a little bit more rigid and less flexible to change. I mean, you sometimes, anyone who's a parent of teenagers knows that they sort of try out different identities and so on and so forth.
Sure.
And then as we grow older and get to middle age, we get pretty set in our personality traits. And of course, what happens with some of these personality traits is they may well become exaggerated into being personality disorder, and the potential for sort of relearning or revisiting that, I think, would be very interesting. And I mean, another point which hasn't come up is that cancer drugs are very focused on epigenetics, but in general, these drugs, which is the type of mechanism we're talking about here with valproate, but in general, these cancer drugs are designed not to get into the brain, and so there may be potential agents that we could use from the oncology field, which have been discarded because they are brain penetrant, which would actually potentially be very useful for this. So, I mean, I think I would just like to sort of highlight that, because something sitting on the shelves of some pharma company as a possible treatment for cancer may actually turn out to be, you know, a very powerful modulator of neuroplasticity, but not be considered for that because it's getting into the brain.
Takao, you're thinking about follow-up studies with valproic acid here on how enduring its effects are and more. Like what?
Well, I think the finding that absolute pitch, for example, could be changed gives us an assay to look into the brain. There have been studies by people like Gottfried Schlauch here at Harvard Medical School who've scanned the brains of people who do have absolute pitch because of early life experience and reported that the structure of their brain is different, that the asymmetry between the right and left hemisphere is perhaps exaggerated, or that there's a hyperconnectivity of particular brain regions, interestingly overlapping with language areas. And so we would like to know, are we really reversing this plasticity by giving a drug to this degree that, in fact, brain wiring is changing? Or are we providing an opportunity to learn the task in some other way that's not actually how we would do it in youth? These are important questions that need to be followed up and have to be looked at. Another is, in a larger cohort of subjects, how enduring is this short exposure? Is this something they now can carry with them for life, or are they actually then losing the skill without maintaining the drug or maintaining the training?
We've got a lot of people asking about Alzheimer's and potential application there. Could you say more about that?
Well, of course. Ultimately, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegeneration. And once you reach the stage of losing neuronal circuitry, it may become harder to try to rescue mm-hmm. function. Again, the notion of trajectory and optimal windows of when this sort of treatment should be made is something very well worth considering. And then perhaps repurposing those circuits that do remain intact longer.
Alan, you know, we were speculating around here before the show about Shakespeare let loose with this, you know, these pills passed out to oldsters and I don't know, all the implications. What's been most interesting to you in the response to all this becoming public, the questions that come up, people's response to the work that you and Takao Hench have done?
Well, I mean, you know, it's very gratifying to scientists like us when anyone ever takes an interest in what we do, because it's very unusual. But but I think this is an exciting area. I think the idea that you can unlock neuroplasticity and change things is tremendously exciting. But before we get too excited, science must kick in, and the basis of science is replication. So we've got to go off and do this study again, and then answer all these questions. And I do think it gives, you know, from my point of view as a physician who treats people with various forms of brain illnesses, I think it's very exciting because it gives us a possible way into future drug development for a whole range of different brain conditions, from Alzheimer's right through to bipolar disorder. And that's something that we really need, because drug development in this area for all of these different conditions has been pretty running up against a brick wall, really, because there's very few new ideas based on a knowledge of underlying brain physiology such as this would be. So I think the potential for treatments for the future is something that really excites me.
Takao, we just have a few seconds here. How much brain plasticity do you think we can handle as humans in the course of a lifetime? Nature gives us a window. You're talking about extending it.
Well, as a parent and observing how wonderful the experience of the childlike mind is and creating who they are, shaping them, I think there's great potential, and we'd like to think it's limitless, but there are a number of other breaks, not just the HDAC, that are making sure we don't change. And in fact, this suggests to me that it's important to not be too plastic.
But you've got us excited. We're listening, we're paying attention. To Cal Hench, Alan Young, thank you for your research, your time. Thank you for being with us today. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.